Okay, and we're live here in the Hello Love. What would you call it? Creative space?
I guess a wellness center, creative space. Yeah, so many different things.
Cool. Mm. So I came here on the tube and it's Holborn, so very Holborn. Central. It's rainy, it's cold, the buses are bumbling down the lane. It's all, you know, very
hectic.
Typical cosmopolitan, busy city. But as soon as I walked in, I definitely felt a change in vibe. It was like a friendly, peaceful, positive place.
Everyone says that. Yeah, they say they come in from the busy road and often people say something brought them here. They were meant to walk down a side street and for some reason they walked down our road. And then they get here and they're like, wow, this is so calm and relaxing and peaceful. And yeah, it's almost got a different vibe when you step inside from the busy road.
Totally, yeah. It's a welcome respite from the chaos that is London.
When you shut the door, you can't hear anything. That's good.
So tell me about this space. How long have you had it, and what's the purpose of this place, and why?
So we've been open about a year and a half now. So Kevin and I started the space. So it's a wellness center that basically educates the community about prevention of illness, especially cancer. I was diagnosed with breast cancer, so we actually give free holistic treatments to people going through cancer. But we've actually widened that out now because we get people coming off the street with all sorts of illnesses and we can't really turn them away, so we offer free services. So we do things like meditation downstairs, we have a dojo, so we do all holistic practices. We have nutrition juice bar upstairs that we do talks and workshops. All sorts of people come in to do educational workshops, talks, lectures. Just so many things.
That's awesome. And that's, you kind of have a charity aspect to this as well, right?
Yeah, so we work for about 40 charities, but the main one's the Hello Beautiful Foundation, which I set up about 5 years ago now. Percentage of all the sales goes to the charities that we work with. So it's basically a social giving space. So everything you buy has a socially conscious purpose to it. Everything in the space is like, everything is organic, everything's non-toxic, so all the products we sell have no chemicals and parabens. Even the paint on our wall is non-toxic paint. We don't use plastics, everything in glass, and just every level we try to think about health and well-being.
Amazing. And you mentioned that you were diagnosed with breast cancer. And we'll get into that a little bit if you don't mind. But do you think that the reason for creating all of this was that linked with the journey you went through because of that? You know,
yeah,
what were you doing
definitely.
Before? Was it?
Yeah, so we have a design studio. So lots of things here. It was almost like the perfect thing. We design retail spaces and we design lots of graphics in retail. So it just seemed like the perfect thing to open. Obviously, when I got diagnosed with cancer, it was like, wow, this is like a purpose now. We can really open a space that talks to similar like-minded people, a place that's relaxing and doesn't feel clinical, doesn't feel like a hospital. And we can really start educating people.
So it's been modelled kind of on your own experience that you went through?
Yeah, definitely.
That's awesome, good for you. So when were you diagnosed?
So I was diagnosed in 2012, and it was completely, I didn't know anything about cancer. Obviously everyone knows the word and it's talked about in like tiny little elements, but I was so clueless. No one in my family had ever had cancer. I remember a friend saying, what was chemo? Do you sit in a room and breathe in oxygen like a gas chamber? Like, not oxygen, do you breathe in chemicals? She thought it was like a torture chamber. And I realized straight then that not really anyone knows what cancer is unless you've been through it yourself or someone close to you.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
I was 35.
So just so young. I mean, no one would expect, especially without a history of any cancer in your family.
And I thought I was really healthy. I thought I was fit. I thought I ate well. I did lots of exercise. You know, there's nothing that I would say. You think, oh, people with cancer are going to smoke or be overweight and all these different things, or someone older. But you never really think it could happen to you. So it opened a brand new door and, new world.
So, yeah, it could really happen to anyone. Mm. So what was the, so you got diagnosed, was it a quick diagnosis? Did this happen all of a sudden?
Really, really quick. So I was lucky, I was in the shower and I was actually going to the doctors that same morning about something else. And I was in the shower and I brushed past, I wasn't even checking myself, but I brushed past my breast and found a lump. Went to the doctors and said, actually, I found this morning. And they said, oh, don't worry, it's probably nothing. Luckily, they said, oh, there is a lump, we'll send you to the hospital, probably a cyst. Even when I got to hospital, the doctor was like, yeah, don't worry about it, it's just a cyst, but we will send you for a mammogram, which is really harmful. Actually, I would never have a mammogram.
What's a mammogram?
So a mammogram is, basically they give you radiation and they do this, it's a big machine that squashes your boobs, but it's radiation that's giving you to see the image of your breasts. And there's so many other ways you can do that without having a mammogram.
So what there's alternatives?
Yeah, there is alternatives. So there's a thermography machine. So I go for that now. We're trying to raise money to get one here because it's obviously where I have to go private, it costs quite a bit, so most people can't do this. I asked the NHS why, because it is actually really cheap, because their mammogram machines cost hundreds of millions of pounds, and this thermography machine costs like, you know, £10,000 at the most, which is nothing. But the whole system, they just can't afford to change what's already in place, because it would cost billions to change. But this, so it basically does infrared imaging, and you can detect cancer a lot quicker and earlier than a mammogram can, because it's seeing your cells change, whereas mammograms actually see the cancer. So it can see changes in your cells, and then it just monitors them from the heat. So it's an amazing.
Wow, it's just incredulous, yeah, that if that's out there, it's not.
And it's infrared, so it's not being harmful at all to your body.
And so you say that's only available in private.
Yeah, private at the moment. Yeah, which is, really upsetting.
So you had
So mammograms, so they only really test women that are older because it's so harmful because of the radiation. So that's why older women, I think over 50 or 55, get sent letters to get a mammogram.
Right.
But they won't do it that often when you're young because it's so harmful.
No, and I wouldn't have thought that something that emits lots of radiation is good for people that potentially have cancer. I wouldn't have thought that that's...
No, it's
a good
terrible.
Mix.
And whenever I go back to the hospital, they always want to give me a mammogram. And I was like, can you give me an ultrasound? And it's always a brick wall. And I have, they make me sit in the waiting room for like 4 hours, I think, on purpose, because I'm being like the difficult patient.
So what actually is the mammogram? Like, is it like an x-ray machine?
Yeah, it's like an x-ray machine. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Well, I'll have to look more
into
that. That's crazy.
Because I used to have them earlier on, not knowing the whole aspect. And once I went, and they had to do it 3 times. So they had to give me the radiation 3 times because it wasn't coming up right in the imaging. So it's like, wow. 3 dosages.
Wow. Yeah. So you had the mammogram, and what it came back showing something not good.
Yeah. So then they sent me for a biopsy. And then, they called me for the results, like, I think it was like a week later. And I went in thinking, I remember someone coming out of the room crying, and I was like, oh no, that's so awful. It must be awful to be diagnosed with cancer. I felt really like bad for her, not knowing I was then going to go in and be told I had cancer as well. But yeah, it's a crazy experience. Because I wasn't even prepared. I was just thinking they were going to say it was nothing.
Oh my gosh. Mm. And how did you feel?
Pretty calm, I think. I felt worse for the people around me, like my family. Obviously, it's worse if your son or daughter are diagnosed, I think, then, you know, it's pretty tough, so.
What were they saying needed to be done? What was the recommended action?
So, yeah, because I didn't know anything, they were like, right, you need to start chemo within 2 weeks, you need to have surgery next week. But this isn't really true, because they only say this because you're now in the system and they have paperwork to do and you're the next patient, so this is their time scale rather than yours, but they'll say, no, you need to do this now. So I didn't know anything about chemo. I knew, because I did a lot of alternative therapies a little bit and was more in that headspace, but I didn't know enough at that time not to do chemo. Personally, I would never do chemo again now, because now I'm trying to get rid of all those toxins from my body. But I did go down the chemo route. And I had to, the first day of chemo, obviously my brain again was a bit all over the place. And they always wait until the last minute to tell you things. So he's like, oh, just before you have chemo, will you come into this side room and sign some paperwork? And I was like, okay, still not thinking. I think lots of people just sign it and don't even read the paperwork. And I had a quick skim, because of course my head was about to get chemo, so my head wasn't really on the paperwork. But I just remember signing that I knew the chemo could give me leukemia and secondary cancers and all sorts of things.
This is just absolutely astounding to me. it doesn't seem right that they would only show you that
crazy.
Kind of all of that disclaimers and warnings about the toxicity of it when you're
before,
actually there because you're already signed up for it at that point. You've already made the deal you know. No, very few people are going to go read it and then go home because also they're going to tell you what's the alternative. Go home and wait to die is probably right.
But all their notes are sealed, so when they give me files, they're all sealed and you can't open them yourself. And I remember once I opened them to read them because they were my files, and they told me off. They're like, you're not allowed to open those. I'm like, well, they're my files, aren't they? You have to pay like £100 to get all your files and get all the information.
What?
And they keep so much from you.
I thought that every human would have had the right to know the data that an organisation holds on them. I would have thought that was enshrined in our data laws.
You have to pay.
Wow.
Well, you did back then.
Oh my gosh. Right. Yeah. So
I think most people are just going through the process. They're not thinking about anything because this our society tells us.
But
this
it's
is
very
what we
hard
need
to actually and scary to question conventional wisdom and conventional Western medicinal practices because you think, well, these organizations have been established for
they know best.
Years and years and people go through rigorous medical training and they do all of these exams and they spend years doing it.
Right.
And so you think, well, they must know what's best.
Yeah, you'd think so. But it's like any job, right? And I've realised over the years when I go in and see an oncologist, and I'm sure there are some amazing oncologists out there, it's just I wasn't lucky enough to meet any. But I'm sure they're like anyone in a job that's been in a job for a lot of years. You get a bit displacent, or you know, you're earning good money and you're just getting through the day and you can't wait to go home. And you know, they're not. I remember after a couple of years, I went back and I'd obviously done a load of research then about estrogens and things. And I spoke to my oncologist about it, all these different things I'd read about, and he didn't have a clue about any of them. And it's like, wow, you really are not researching about the topic you're involved with every day. You're not really researching and keeping on top of tamoxifen. Maybe just the few little notes you were sent or a few things I were meant to read, but you wasn't looking outside the box that was sent to.
And when you start thinking like that, it becomes really scary because I agree with you, and the way that I see it is that what the healthcare are very good at doing is sticking to the narrative and within the confines, which when you look at holistically all the thousands of years of medicine and plants and herbal, it's quite a small box, which is Western medicine toolkit. And they're good at following that process and doing that.
Yeah.
But it feels like that is a very small part of the bigger picture. Yeah. And anything else, it's the worrying thing is often the attitudes. They're scorned, you know, things are blown out of proportion in terms of risks. Mm. And it's the wrong attitude for me, you know. It should be an open an attitude of openness and of saying we could be wrong about this. Our knowledge is still evolving.
Yeah. Well, I know loads of women of cancer that have been chucked out of the room. That the oncologist is like, I don't want to hear this. Just leave. You can't be my patient anymore. Like so many times, like they've made me cry. They've just been brutal. It's like, almost like brute force. So someone I know cured her stage 4 cancer. And she went back to her, they gave her 3 months to live, and she 2.5 years later, this is 12 years ago now, but she went back to her oncologist and said, the next person you give a terminal illness to, will you tell them about me? Will you tell them to come and see me to give them hope at least and a chance? And the oncologist just said, oh, sorry, I'm too busy.
what do you think's going on in his mind to say that?
In a way, I think lots of doctors and people don't want to be told that they're maybe wrong or maybe don't have all the knowledge. And for someone, it's almost like a power trip thing in lots of cases, which is such a sad way to be, but it's almost like the way that Western society has started to evolve, like these hierarchies of different people. And
yeah, and I can understand that actually, you know, like if I'd spent my whole life working at something and then something came along that was basically saying, well, there's actually other ways of doing this.
Yeah.
There's better ways of doing it.
You
definitely, when I looked to the ego in me, it would be like, no, this you know, there'd be anger.
Right.
You know, there'd be anger there for sure, and there'd be fear.
Right.
But yeah. it's not how we can go about people. Well, we're better than that.
Yeah,
we're better than that. And it's, you're right. I think there is a big fear of being wrong and probably some egos playing into it.
I have heard and seen people, other oncologists around the world that have been disillusioned and have seen other ways. Now they've changed their practices and they're doing more holistic approaches to medicine. But if you look at China, for instance, when people are diagnosed with a terminal illness or something similar, they're like, we don't go to the hospital to get, you go to hospital to get fixed if you've got a broken arm or something, but if you've got something chronic wrong with you, then you're going to look at herbs and more of a holistic doctor rather than someone that's going to cut and burn and poison you.
It makes sense to me. I feel like in the West we don't have any sort of grasp on ailments that aren't as obvious to the naked eye or to an x-ray machine. Mental health problems, problems that come from the mind, that come from stress. I don't feel like we might have much of a handle on that right now.
But I think that stress plays a major role in cancer as well. Like the amount of women that come here with all sorts of different cancers, and I ask each one of them, I say, have you had an emotional trauma or stress or something prior to your cancer? And everyone will say yes, something pretty major. Because when our cells, when our mind's not right in our body, our thoughts are negative or upset, then our cells aren't happy and they can't heal. Because everyone does have cancer in their bodies, but most people it just flushes out and it doesn't turn into anything. But if you're constantly in a state of, you know, turmoil or negative thinking, then your cells aren't going to heal properly, which can lead to malfunctions and cancer can start to grow.
So there we go.
So much research.
The answer is not to stress. Easier said than done. The amount of people I've said not to worry about something and then worried profusely myself over smaller things.
It's crazy. But when I got diagnosed, it's like instantly, like I had fear of like heights. That went instantly. Like I used to get sweaty palms walking over bridges. It was horrendous. And it just went instantly. It's like, what is the point of these fears?
Wow.
Things like that, yeah. But like other people are like, oh, my washing machine broke and it's the worst thing in the world. And it's like, not really. There's, you know, there's no real reason to get stressed about most things that we stress about.
So it gave you perspective.
Definitely, yeah.
So, okay, so you get the diagnosis, then what, a week or two later you're in. Do they have the, and forgive my ignorance, but where they administer the chemotherapy, is that in a hospital? Do they have specialist buildings for this?
Oh yeah, they have a chemo room that's the most hideous place. So it's full to brim of cakes. They come around with a trolley, there's not even an apple on the trolley, it's crisps, white sandwiches, you know, white bread and processed ham and stuff and cakes everywhere because everyone's coming in giving the nurses a cake or biscuits or thank you for looking after me, there's cake everywhere and obviously sugar fuels cancer.
Yeah, what do we know about sugar and cancer?
So there's so much research these days. So refined sugar, so when you go into hospital and, so I had a scan then, an MRI scan to see if the cancer had spread, and they basically put glucose in your body, which is sugar, so the glucose rushes to the cancer cell and lights up any cancer in your body because cancer loves sugar and it helps to fuel it. So they've been doing this for years.
This is like an episode of Black Mirror. They're feeding stuff that fuels cancer to patients waiting for their chemotherapy cancer treatment.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's crazy. And there's so much, there is like, it's starting to shift a little bit and more people are becoming aware, but even you see these other cancer charities that are doing all these cake sales and it's just full of cake and sugar. I mean, it's so obvious that, you know, what you put in your body is your health and well-being, right?
Yeah.
It's like what you put in the car, you wouldn't put the wrong petrol in the car and expect it to run. But we're just eating all sorts of rubbish and Coke and eating McDonald's and all this processed. Like, I go into supermarkets now and it's like hardly anything to buy because there's rows and rows and rows of processed foods, sugar-filled foods. Even in like, if you go to, I don't know, a well-known sandwich place in the high street, half their salads are full of sugar that they put in to preserve them longer.
Yeah.
And these things that you don't even realise.
Yeah, like they're branded as healthy products.
Yeah, you think they're healthy, but they're full of sugar.
It's really, really tricky.
Preservatives and all sorts.
Yeah, that's you're right. It's actually really difficult finding good food. Because I'll be honest, I can't always be bothered to cook.
Right.
And I've had some extremely tasty, like, vegan meals, and I eat that, and I think I could honestly happily eat that kind of stuff for the rest of my life, and I would be so happy. But it's the availability. It's the availability isn't there yet for me, because, you know, you look down the street at the food and it's Subway, KFC, McDonald's, all of these, as you say, processed. 80% of the stuff.
It's so quick and easy.
Yeah, it's the convenience. Yeah. It's, when it's a shame, because we can, you could, it, the plant-based stuff, the healthy stuff, it can be quick and easy, can be convenient. But I guess I think we're seeing that shift in, it's got to be consumer-driven. Mm. More people that start adopting plant-based diets. Yeah. We're seeing loads of new vegan stuff coming up. And yeah, to be honest, I want to see the rapid commercialization of ethical plant-based companies that give back into the communities and go and move into the you know, the empty McDonald's lots.
Exactly, it would be great.
It'd be wishful thinking. But one day I think we'll you know, we will get there. But the thing that then all these companies do is they realize they're losing, and then they will actually start, you know, organizing in an ethical way or having healthy food just to stay in the game, not doing it for the right reasons, to do it as a self-preservation, but which is what we're seeing in cannabis, right? Pharmaceutical companies lobbying, spending millions every year to spread false information, propaganda about how dangerous cannabis is. Now what you're seeing, you're seeing them apply for patents about cannabis so they can sell cannabis-based medicines because they know they're losing the war. So yeah, I think as part of it, we all need to kind of educate ourselves around where we're putting our money and what we're putting in our bodies.
But even here, so we sell juices, cold pressed juices that are based on the Gerson therapy, which lots of people take when they're wanting to heal cancer and alternatively, but we sell it more as a prevention. Our juices are quite expensive, but that's because we're hardly making any profit at all on them. You know, they're full of, one carrot juice is full of a whole bag of carrots, organic carrots, and then it's in a glass bottle. So by the time you've done that, it's already quite costly. So people coming off the street and they'll be like, how much? I can go to Sainsbury's and get a juice that's like a litre big, not realising it's got like 1% of juice in it and the rest of sugar and all sorts of different chemicals.
And what's the true cost of that to your body?
Right, exactly. And it may cost like £1 or less than £1, but it's just full of rubbish. It's that education of people and telling them, you know, this actually contains this many carrots, this many, and the green juice contains all sorts of different things. So yeah, it's just that education, and to actually show them, it's almost like, look at this bag of carrots, like a whole kilogram of carrots.
And people don't realize it's all gone into that. Yeah. That's cool. So if we can go back to, the chemotherapy, because this is, you know, I've not had any experience with this, and I think a lot of people, as you say, are completely clueless and lack of transparency into what that process looks like. So you've gone to this wing of the hospital, they're serving you the sugary snacks, and this is when they get you to go into a separate room to sign, and what is it? Is it a disclaimer?
Yeah, disclaimer. So it was like, I don't know, it was quite a big document. And he just said, oh, just sign on the back. He didn't want me to read it. And it was too big to read. Because he's like, you're trying to rush me, you know, you need to start your chemo in a few minutes, so we'll sign this quickly. So then you go into the room, it's like a group room, and you get your own little seating area, and they bring this solution. But that's the scary thing as well. And again, your head really isn't in it, but they're bringing this bag of this red, it's disgusting, it's this red solution that has, so the nurses have gloves on, they have a thing over the mouth so they don't breathe in the toxic, and on the packaging it's like danger, toxic chemicals, and they say if it leaks, so someone's had to have their arm amputated before because the drip of the chemo's fallen on the arm, and if it falls, if it gets outside your veins, then you can have your arm amputated. It basically burns through your skin, and this is going into your body. So basically there's different ways to administer it through your veins, but then your veins get weak, so eventually they made me, I didn't want to do it, they put a PICC line in my arm, which is threaded through your whole arm up to your shoulder through there, and then it's just left hanging through your heart, next to your heart. So the chemo is just seeping through all your body next to your heart. So your heart can get damaged, like everything gets damaged.
So it's a liquid. The chemotherapy is a liquid.
Yeah, and it's different. Some take pills, but for breast cancer, then it's mainly a liquid. And right. breast cancer chemo is one of the worst, like the most toxic. That's why lots of women with breast cancer lose all their hair. Yeah, and other chemos aren't as toxic. And
And so this, so is it quite a big bag? Is it like just one of those kind of IV
hours,
looking?
It took me 8 hours.
So you have to sit there hooked
for 8 hours. For 8 hours.
So how were you feeling like before you went in, and how were you feeling straight after? Was there any difference?
So they give you loads of steroids before, because your body, it kills everything in your body. Basically, chemo can kill cancer cells, but it kill everything. And in my mind, if you, you know, if you don't treat the root cause of cancer, it'll just grow back again. Because what have you done to stop it? You've just done chemo. It's like a nuclear bomb, right? It goes off in your body, blasts it all away, but then after a while, it can just grow back again.
Well, there's also studies showing that what the areas where chemotherapy has been working, on that outer region, it's more likely to then develop cancer,
right, yeah.
because it's more exposed from the chemotherapy. Yeah.
But even surgery, you can spread through your blood system. Cancer cells can start spread when you start to mess around with your body. But our bodies are naturally designed to heal ourselves. It's just that education of being able to. And people have such a fear of cancer. And I think the word is just so fearful. So I think it's getting rid of that fear and just thinking, oh, my body's telling me it needs to be healed or something's not right. So what steps do I need to do to change and do things to help myself rather than sit there and get this trip? Of chemo going through your blood. I mean, it is crazy, really. How can you really think that some... It was developed in chemical warfare. It was for, like, some torture thing, and they realised it was helping someone with cancer. So I can't remember the exact facts, but it was a brutal thing that was helped. And, of course, it will kill cancer because it can kill everything in your body.
Yeah, I mean, you kill everything, there's no more cancer left.
Exactly. I have so many issues from it still.
Do we know what the success rate of chemotherapy is?
This is what is so strange, because after 5 years, they say if you get cancer again after 5 years, they wipe you off after 5 years. So that's like, oh, that's it, you're in remission, and then after 5 years, you're healed. So if it comes back after 5 years and one day, it's a new case. So for them, chemo's worked. And so I think that's how it's so blurry. So... to be honest, and so many young people that I've met that had cancer in their 20s or 30s have got it later in life, but because they haven't done things to help change their lifestyle.
They haven't changed their diet, they haven't...
Diet.
Well, I guess they haven't been advised to.
No, yeah, lots of the time you're not advised to make any changes.
Mm. Gosh, so... So how did this stuff like make you feel, and how long did you have to do it for? So you did one 8-hour session. Was that it, or were there more?
No, so it was took 6 months, I think. So I went every 3 weeks. So you feel dreadful for the first 2 weeks, say, and then the last week you start to feel better again, and then you're back at it. But yeah, you had so many steroids, so many anti-sickness drugs. Like I was on, I didn't realize at the time what exactly I was taking, but tramadol and so many different things that are just, I looked them up afterwards, and it's like Talk to Frank website that are on about hardcore drug addicts that take tramadol, and it's such a crazy, crazy drug.
And how are you feeling like in your head? How is it affecting you mentally?
It's hard to say. I think because I was so positive and already on the quest to change things, that it was a lot different for me. But yeah, I was sluggish and wasn't really concentrating right. And yeah, it does affect you. Yeah, there's drugs are pretty nasty.
So what happened after the chemotherapy? So 6 months, are they tracking you throughout this? Are they just, you know, do they have to wait a certain amount and then go and look at things again?
No, they never really scanned me again until after all the process was done. I also had to get my eggs frozen, because they don't tell you that chemo can make you infertile. So they told me that, like, they basically throw everything on you like a few days before, and then you have to make decisions of what to do. So I got my eggs frozen before I had chemo, then I had chemo, then I had radiotherapy, which is another crazy thing, because it's just like radiation to your body.
And so how does that work?
So that is like a beam of radiation that goes into your... So they do it directly onto where the cancer was and then do a general area thing. But I've met so many people that had breast cancer when they were young, and now they've got thyroid cancer because the whole area includes your thyroids and your lungs. I couldn't breathe. Like, I felt like an old lady. I couldn't even walk more than 20 meters without sitting down.
Well, after this, after doing this?
Well, just through the whole chemo.
Throughout this whole period?
I used to get the tube. They say don't do anything, just sit at home and watch telly and give up on life, basically. But I didn't do that. I carried on working everything. I was like, nothing, I'm just going to carry on. So I'd get the tube every day, but it was a struggle to breathe. And I used to have to just sometimes sit down on the floor in the middle of the tube. And I remember walking from here, Holborn, just to Oxford Circus one night. I was like, I'm going to do it. And I was just absolutely exhausted because you feel like an old person. You just have no energy, no breath. Like, your heart is damaged from the chemo and radiation. And yeah,
it's sounds pretty awful. Brutal. Yeah, it sounds really
horrible. And before cancer, I felt very healthy, and then as soon as you start treatment, you look like death. Like, obviously all my hair fell out, I was losing loads of weight, and things are going wrong in your body that weren't wrong with it before. You get nerve damage, so you can't feel the end of your fingers, which sometimes doesn't even come back. My nails went black and all fell off, and so many different things.
That's just awful. And speaking around stuff like this makes you think a lot about kind of quality versus quantity a lot of these treatments seem to take away the quality, and I guess you know if it's a temporary thing, then that's fine, but if there's other alternatives. And so what point were you looking at alternatives to the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy?
So I mean, because I had no research, so it was just, I started to read books, doing research from the first day I was diagnosed. But it wasn't until, I'd obviously then done all the treatments, so it wasn't maybe until 6 months after I'd finished that my decision was made that I wish I hadn't done all this. Because you're still learning as you go. You're still thinking, well, chemo must be right because this is what everyone does. So even though in the back of your head I'm thinking, well, I must do all these things to help my body, boost my body up on the side, going through chemo, all these alternative things, I still wasn't in the space of, this is completely wrong for me. But like you said about quality of life, I've met so many women, like, not everyone's going to live, not everyone's going to, die, no matter what direction you take. But I've seen so many women, some of my friends, that have had a reoccurrence and then they go down the chemo route, and in the end they have no quality of life. Like you said, they're in hospital for the rest of their life, they're having so many more drugs, it affects the whole quality, so they spend their whole last few years in hospital, like, awful. Whereas other friends that have done alternatives have lived happily, gone traveling, not really felt much pain, felt quite fine. And then one of my friends died, and a week before you wouldn't even know she was about to die. And it's like, if you're going to die, how would you like to die? Would you like to die in pain? Another friend had chemo and everything, and she was in absolute agony. Morphine wouldn't help at all. She was just, it was awful. And another friend did loads of CBD, and she had no pain. She still died, but she died very peacefully and without pain. And
wow. Nice. Yeah, that's... The cannabis seems to definitely help with counteracting some of the negative side effects from chemo. Yeah. I've certainly heard that, and I think that with the legalization, or let's call it legal light diet legalization, that's happening today, 1st of November, it's being rolled out. It's very, very baby steps, but I think one of the use cases that they've mentioned is around people that are resistant to typical pain medications when going through chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So as I understand it, like, anyone can apply to get medical cannabis. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to fail, to be honest.
Yeah.
But that seems one of the use cases. They've got like two or three. Yeah. Another one's like pediatric epilepsy and some small use cases. Right. So it seems like that's kind of a well-known one, but
because one of my, sorry, One of my friends at the moment, she's got, well, they've said, and I hate the way doctors tell someone this, but they told her it was terminal. They said, we can't do anything else for you, so we can't give you any more drugs. So she's now asked for the medical cannabis, but they're still, she said, there's so much, she's buying it on the side herself, and they're like upset that she's doing that. She's, mm-hmm. And she's like, well, what am I meant to do? Can you not give me it? And still, like you said, people aren't really getting it.
It's a real mess, to be honest. Mm. It's a real mess, like you say, with the radiography machines. Like, a lot of the NHS, a lot of the underlying infrastructure is broken, doesn't seem effective to me.
Yeah.
There are probably interested stakeholders with lots of influence that are making decisions that aren't best for the patients. So it's difficult trying to force something that we all know is good and it like holds massive value when you've got all of this
massive system
stuff going on. There's no visibility it's
because it's such a massive system. To change anything there will take years, years and years and years.
It's a really tough one because, you know, I love the NHS. I love that you have somewhere you can go and you can get treated if you're sick for free. Like, I love that.
Exactly.
But then, you know, there needs to be some changes. And unfortunately, I don't think throwing money at it's the answer. I mean, I definitely think throw money at the nurses, you know, the people working the long shifts. Right? Throw money at them.
Yeah.
Don't throw money just at the NHS expecting it to improve because I think it will just go down a black hole and probably never see it again. But we've talked about a lot of, you know, the kind of negative stuff, and it must have been very hard what you've been through. But it seems that was, 5 years ago? So I guess according to...
Well, over 5 years now. So over five. According to the doctors,
so you're cured now?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's awesome. I'm really happy about that. But what would you say is some of the stuff that you've learned over the last few years about kind of, I mean, what does your regime look like in terms of trying to make sure this cancer never comes back?
Well, I tell people, because when I tell people about all I do, they're like, oh my God, that's so much. How am I going to do this? It's too much. I can't do it. That's the first thing. So I say to anybody, it's like a daily practice. Where I am today wasn't where I was a year ago or 2 years ago. It's daily change. So now I'm eat total plant-based diet. But at the beginning, I didn't. I thought, I need to change this. So I'd eat chicken maybe once a week, and I'd slowly make changes, because I think if you do things all together, it's too stressful, which isn't good for you, and you can't not have fun, or you can't just deny yourself everything overnight, because that is not the way to go. So for me, and I think if I'd had a more later stage cancer, then I'd have had to do things overnight, because if I was going to go down like the Gerson therapy, lots of people have healed cancer from that.
And so what is that? Is that about juicing?
Yeah, so that is 13 juices a day, and they all need to be cold pressed, organic, fresh.
Plant. And based on our earlier conversation, that's a hell of a lot of fruit and veg.
But what else is there? So a coffee enemas and a plant-based diet. So people do that for like 2.5 years.
And is that juicing? Is that instead of, like, do you replace those juices with meals? Sorry, the other way around.
No, you still eat. Right. So you still have breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Oh,
so
I'm all right then. I can do that.
And then basically it's detoxing your liver, it's detoxing your whole body and putting an overload of good nutrients into your cells. So your body is flushing out. So some people actually have like, I don't know what it is, like it almost looks like pus coming, seeping out of the end of their skin, because it's just detoxing all of our toxins away.
That's crazy.
And in the end, the cancer just can't cope. It's just getting flushed with goodness and goodness and goodness.
Yeah, it thrives in like an acidic environment, doesn't it?
Yeah, so you need an alkaline body.
It makes sense.
Yeah. No sugar, no alkaline, and then, you know, you can heal yourself.
And this juicing, is that like, do they recommend this as a maintenance ongoing, do it every day, or is it like, do it for 3 months and you're good for a year? How does it work?
So most people, it's different for everybody as well, and you need to do blood tests and things to see how many coffee enemas you need, which are different for everybody, and how long you need to do it for. But then you can't just be like, oh yeah, I've healed my cancer, now I'm going to go back and eat McDonald's. So it's just maintaining. So Beata Bishop, an amazing lady that healed her cancer years ago now, I think she's in her 90s, she did a talk for us a few years ago. And she's like, she now eats chicken once a week, but it's all organic chicken. The cancer, they gave her, again, like a few months to live, and she did the Gerson for 2.5 years, but she's like, it's maintaining. She's not now still juicing 13 times a day, but it's just the whole health benefits that she does, everything. So it's a whole like mind, body, soul thing. So I think you can't do one with, not without the other. Like I could eat as healthy as I wanted to, but if my mind isn't right and I'm stressed and I haven't looked at like holistic practices, then it's not really going to do much good.
Mm.
But it might for some, but you know,
yeah,
it's all different sorts of things.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mm. And so finally, people that are listening, people may have been inspired, people may be going through their own journeys right now.
Mm.
What's the best way for them to get involved with what you're doing?
So we're open 7 days a week, and the website is hellalove.org for the space itself, and hellabeautiful.org is the charity. So they can come along every day. We have different classes, workshops, we do meditation, sound massage, gong baths, everything and everything, yoga, nutrition talks, lucid dreaming, out-of-body experiences, like all these things that it's just so much to learn, and we're introducing new things all the time, so...
Awesome. Yeah. It was an eclectic mix of events and stuff. I'm going to get involved with something like lucid dreaming. That sounds
great. And hemp
great.
Festivals. We did a hemp festival.
Of course, yeah. That was good. Yeah, I know. It's a fantastic space, and what you guys are doing is very, very inspiring. And thank you very much
for
your time. It was
really
nice speaking.